What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
Right now, we're inside a computer program.
Is it really so hard to believe? Your clothes are different, the plugs in your arms and head are gone. Your hair has changed. Your appearance now is what we call residual self-image. It is the mental projection of your digital self.
So 200 years from now, what will people think of The Matrix? Still impressed with slow-motion bullets and red pill, blue pill postmodernism? Or will they see it as a subversive pop culture text about gender identity?
This is all assuming it'll be possible to watch films in the Mad Max-style wasteland of the future.
Yes, but with the doof warrior, Josh, who needs movies?
True.
That Matrix question, one asked by writer Chuck Klosterman in his new book, But What If We're Wrong, Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past? Klosterman joins us to pontificate about the top five movies future historians will remember.
This was a hard one.
So hard. That and more ahead on Film Spotting, episode 600.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive.
The 600th episode of Film Spotting, appropriately, is supported by Film Spotting listeners, including new $5 a month subscriber Carson in Vancouver, Jason Poon in Hong Kong, happy 30th birthday, Jason, Paul in Melbourne, Australia, Paul, we wish you all the best, and J.D. Duran and the In Session Film Podcast. Josh, J.D. says he hopes his next donation comes in the form of buying you guys a beer at the Tampa Film Spotting Meetup. Make that happen, Adam.
Sounds good to me, J.D. We also received a donation from Jim Pellini in Bethpage, New York. Congratulations on 600. I'm very proud to support the best podcast on earth every month, but felt this milestone warranted a bit extra in the envelope. Episode 271, your review of Inglourious Basterds, contained my favorite film spotting moment of all time. In addition to delivering a very engaging review of the film, Adam and Maddie's erudite championing of the artist's right to use history as a launching pad to inform their artistic vision connected with me on a base level. I recall that discussion often when considering a challenging film or trying to discern a filmmaker's particular point of view. Much thanks for that memory and all the others.
Thank you, Jim. We also got a donation from a longtime listener and supporter, Rob Cosgrove in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He says, that's what I love about Film Spotting, man. You keep getting better and I stay the same. At least my limited economic resources do. So it's a dime a show to pay tribute to your 600th episode. I just wish I could give you that MacArthur Foundation green, but even that would not make up for all the hours of pleasure you've given me. Thank you, Adam, Josh, Sam, and the ghost of Maddie Ballgame, whose Synecdoche, New York rant lives shimmeringly in my memory.
Thanks, Rob, and to all of our donors. Of course, there's a no-cost way to support the show as well. Just rate or review us on iTunes. We want to give thanks to Natalie Song and Swedish Meatballs, Sam Van Hogren name, who posted quick reviews over the past week.
In the year 3535, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the bill.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. So, Josh, this show is all about looking ahead, looking way ahead, in fact, with Chuck Klosterman and the top five movies historians of the future will remember. But we're also going to take some time to look back because, as we've noted, it is our birthday, sort of, 600 episodes.
600.
Yeah.
And I've been around for what percentage of those?
So
am I approaching 50%?
I did not break down the percentages, but I did do a little bit of homework because I thought this might come up. And the fact is, you have the longest tenure of any Film Spotting co-host.
Really?
Is that actually foreboding at this point?
I don't know how to take that, but the fact that you put in all those extra hours, I think explains why you just look so much more tired than I do.
Maybe so. You officially joined the show. You had appeared a few times before that during the whole audition process, but your first official show was episode 382,
okay,
by my count. So if we're at 600, you've been on for 218 episodes. That means you surpassed one Sam Van Hogren, now producer of the show, on episode 559, and you surpassed Maddie Ballgame at episode 572. So
do I get a trinket, a little prize?
You should
something?
Get something. I got you
a
watch.
I don't see anything here.
It's in my bag.
Okay,
I got
good.
You a watch. It's even engraved. Depending on how long we go with Chuck Losterman here. This might be a party that only our podcast listeners get invited to. Of course, our radio listeners here on WBEZ in Chicago and elsewhere may get an abbreviated version of the show, but we will get to some listener feedback and some of our own feedback as we reflect on 600 episodes here. You can get the full version of the show at filmspotting.net or on iTunes or your preferred podcast app. All that, again, later in the show. Josh, let's go ahead and get to our guest. Chuck Losterman is on the line joining us from the Panoply Studios in Brooklyn. Chuck is the great pop culture journalist, essayist, and novelist. He's the author of several books I can highly recommend, including Fargo Rock City, A Heavy Metal Odyssey in Rural North Dakota, Killing Yourself to Live, 85% of a True Story, and Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, A Low Culture Manifesto, along with several other fascinating books with and without colons in their titles. His latest, with colon, is But What If We're Wrong? Thinking about the present as if it were the past. And actually, that's not really true, Chuck. I don't think there is a colon. There's just the question mark there. In it, Chuck throws Aristotle under the bus for his crazy ideas about gravity. So what does Chuck think historians of the future will do with Alfonso Cuarón's gravity? That's more or less the idea we've been grappling with for the past week or so. Chuck, you were the number one guest I wanted to have on for our 600th episode. Thanks so much for making the time.
I appreciate being number 600. Who is number 500?
Who's Ryan Johnson, yeah, the director of Brick and the upcoming Star Wars movie.
We tend to celebrate these 100 episodes in high style.
Who was 100?
So. Yeah.
Like, so, who was 100?
Who was 100?
Like, still in the...
We had another director on, Dylan Kidd, the writer and director of Roger Dodger. Have you seen that film?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a long time ago.
A long time ago. Yes.
It was 600 shows.
600
That's
shows.
That's a lot of shows.
500 shows ago. Well, this should be fun, Chuck, especially because I now finally get to reveal the secret I've been keeping from Josh for this past week. All the stress I've put him through coming up with this top five list was all just a smokescreen, because what's really about to happen is he's going to sit in stunned silence while we share our top five Kiss songs, followed by our top five Motley Crue songs. And it's going
okay,
to be glorious.
Okay, great. We've turned the tables. Okay. Let's start with The Elder. Okay.
Okay, well, then I'm in trouble, because you definitely go deeper there on Kiss than I do. But I think we're definitely going to get into your book in pretty good detail as we go through our top five list and we go through our explanations and just what we were thinking as we tried to come up with these lists. But I did want to start with something I just discovered over the weekend, a quote. I was watching the new Werner Herzog film. Have you had a chance to see it yet, Chuck? Are you familiar with it? Lo and behold, Reveries of the Connected World?
I have not. I've only seen the trailer.
Okay, so there's a part in there that really resonated with me as I've been thinking about your book for a while here. He has on the theoretical physicist and cosmologist Lawrence Krauss, and Krauss says this: "That's one of the wonderful things about the future. You don't know where it's going to go. If you think about predictions about the future as done in the past, they always miss the important stuff. In fact, most science fiction missed the most important thing about the present world, which is the internet itself. They had flying cars, they had rocket ships. None of that exists, but the internet governs our lives today." So you talk about this and actually kind of maybe explain it or have an answer to that in your book, where you talk about how if we're going to try to figure out what we are going to appreciate down the road or the way things might be in the future, 200 to 300 years from now, that's obviously very difficult, because we have to first construct that future, and that's hard.
Yes, and it's a very difficult thing to do. And you know, the natural inclination is to always look at the world of the present and just sort of extrapolate out from that. And just think of what is central to the world now, and let's extend that, or let's amplify it. And, you know, this is how you get something like the idea of a flying car. You look at the importance of cars, and you see planes, and you want to merge them. That's a very interesting point about science fiction, because it's true, there's not a lot of, you know, seminal sci-fi that deals with the idea of the internet, although that's also partially a problem of how do you illustrate that in a book or in a movie. If someone sitting around typing doesn't seem that visual, you know, that might be part of the reason why it was like absent from the sci-fi of the 50s.
Yeah, absolutely. So hopefully that will kind of set the table here for what we're going to get into. And Josh is actually going to start us off, and then we'll go to you, Chuck, and then come back around to me as we get through our lists. And we're sharing the top five movies historians of the future will remember. And this is difficult for all the reasons that we just talked about here. And mainly, I found myself, the more confident I was with my reasoning behind a certain pick, the more sure I was then that I was completely wrong. I mean, that seems kind of the basic premise of your whole book. So I've never had a top five that I was trying to come up with that I felt like the more I knew, the less I knew. And I imagine you kind of felt that way writing this book, maybe.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the history of ideas is the history of people being wrong. And if you're going to sort of build a book around ideas that have not yet to happen, you're essentially guaranteeing that most of what you're projecting is going to be incorrect. And you have to almost build that into your rationale and logic. And it's like a tautology. It's like every time you think of something that seems plausible, that almost proves it's incorrect.
So how in the world, Chuck, did you know when you were done writing this book? That's what struck me, is because if you're constantly second-guessing yourself, and that's what you do throughout the book, you're considering all of these ideas from every possible angle. How did you know when you were ready to say, okay, I've gone down this rabbit hole as far as I can go? Or do you feel like you could still be doing that?
No, I mean, I still could be doing that, although to be honest, that's the case with all of my books, and I think probably for most books for most writers. I mean, if I could, and if there was a perfect world where every year somebody put $1 million in my checking account and all I had to do was keep working on and rewriting Fargo Rock City and have it never be published, that would be my dream.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I would just love to have that first book and just write it over and over and over again and have no one see it but myself, but okay, also be rich. So at some point you just say, like, hey, this is, you know, this is never going to be done, but I'm calling it done. And here we go. You know, I guess that's just how it is.
I guess that's what deadlines are for. So,
yeah. So,
well, as we jump into our list, yeah, I mean, the guiding principle for me from the book, But What If We're Wrong, is that this whole exercise is folly that the three of us are about to do, right? So that being understood, I'm going to suggest a few things that I used when I did form my list. And for me, I thought of these as time capsule movies that nobody right now would even think to put in the time capsule. So right away, I could discount a couple things. Commercial success doesn't matter. In fact, it should probably discount a movie from my list. Critics don't matter. We got to admit this up front, the three of us, right?
So true.
In fact, movies that are generally considered bad or dismissible right now, maybe those should be given extra consideration for my list. Here's the helpful quote that I found from your book, Chuck. The reason something becomes retrospectively significant in a far-flung future is detached from the reason it was significant at the time of its creation. And that's almost always due to a recalibration of social ideologies that future generations will accept as normative. So I did find that helpful, I think mostly in terms of what to avoid. So I'm still not getting to the point where I'm adding titles to the list, right? It's just, what am I going to avoid? How did I think about what am I going to look for? Two qualities, all right? Genre, it seems to me, stands the test of time, okay? It's partly why we still revere something like Homer's Odyssey. And you're going to notice on my list that horror has a prominent presence for this reason. Also, when movies become artifacts, and that's essentially what we're talking about, I think subtext becomes the foreground. So I did choose those films with ripe subtext.
Okay.
That's how I went about this impossible task.
Now, undercut all of that with your number 5.
With my first pick. All right, with my first pick, remember what I said about bad movies being eligible, okay? M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening. I'm going with The Happening. You're not going to get a defense from me of this infamous 2008 thriller about killer plants. I watched it again for this list, and it is still shockingly terrible. Shyamalan is a filmmaker that I do admire. I love a lot of his pictures for their craft. This is not one of them. But let's step away from craft and consider what the movie means to tap into, what it tried to do, okay? Our extreme anxiety over the environment, whether pollution, global warming, fossil fuel use, whatever it is, it's been one of the defining global issues of our age. And I do think that the idea Shyamalan devised here is actually horrifyingly ingenious, okay? Just put the movie out of your head. It's that plants are releasing toxins which cause humans to commit suicide. So this isn't just nature getting revenge, okay? We've seen movies like that. It's a sadistic play on the idea that by degrading the environment, we're literally killing ourselves, okay? And I think this whole notion lends a couple meanings to what's a pretty clever shot in the film. At one point, they're in a field that's being turned into a subdivision, and the billboard selling it says, "You deserve this." I like that touch.
You think it could be plants?
I don't know. But if it is, and people are setting it off in groups, we need to go to the least populated place we can to be safe. Can't walk to the borders where this isn't happening, Elm. That's too far.
Whatever it is, terrorists, a nuclear leak, plants, it's probably safe to get away from people right now.
That must be Arendelle. It's 10 miles from here.
Okay, this place must have a bathroom. I'm gonna take Jess and we can leave.
Hurry.
Without a doubt, mostly, though, this is poorly executed. Shyamalan tries to evoke the wind as a threat frequently. It does not work. He's no Ho Xiao Shen. This isn't The Assassin, where the wind was bent to that filmmaker's will. But for all the ineptitude, I think there's still enough creepiness here to make it memorable. I think the scenes of the construction workers jumping to their deaths works, as well as those tree trimmers hanging themselves from the branches. So I'm going to propose that something like The Happening, okay, if not The Happening, something like The Happening might just be valued 200 years from now, for the same reason that some of us still enjoy something like 1954's Them, this schlocky sci-fi feature about giant ants. I mean, that one spoke to an earlier era's fears, in that case atomic, in a way that's historically fascinating to me, even if those fears didn't come to fruition, you know? So it's not a prediction of the future that came true so much, but it speaks to the fears of that time. So maybe, just maybe, The Happening will work the same way.
You know, I have to say that's a pretty good answer. I don't think that will specifically be happen. I don't think it'll be that movie, but there's a couple things about it that I think are smart. One is that the problems it has with craft and the terrible acting in that film, after enough time passes, almost all acting seems stiff and bad. Hmm. If you look at a movie like, I don't know, like Sunrise from like 1927 or whatever.
Sure.
If you watch that today, you're not going to say, boy, that's the naturalism of these actors. Like, you would never say that. It's, you almost go in conceding that the acting and sort of the film grammar and stuff is going to be just schlocky and all over the place. So The Happening, as bad as it seems now, won't seem as bad in a distant future, because most of the films from this period will seem that way to somebody who has yet to be born and, you know, and looks back on this in 2070. The other thing about that movie, and if you just saw it, you'll be able to remember this more than I, there is one amazing scene in it where it's late in the movie and like an old woman is yelling at Mark Wahlberg, and his reaction is like, what? Me? No. It's like he doesn't seem to understand what the rest of the movie is for that singular scene. I think it was one of the funniest things I ever saw.
I hear you whispering, planning on stealing something.
No, ma'am, we're not.
Plan on murdering me in my sleep.
What? No.
It is so strange, and I couldn't make any more sense of it this last time. Hey, maybe that's one of those things that will have huge subtext, though, in 200 years. Then we'll figure out what that was all about.
Maybe so. I think, isn't it Jane Alexander maybe in that scene? But yeah, I mean, it's crazy, and there's a reason why that whole bit with Wahlberg has become a pretty lasting internet meme. So Chuck, Josh seem to have got us started on the right note. I think everything he said was more compelling than The Happening was to actually watch. What's your number five?
Well, you know, I did this, I think, a little differently.
Okay.
Because I did it sort of the same way I worked through a lot of these problems in my book, which is that I tried to get away from starting with the merit and the content of the stuff. Because if you start from that, you're inevitably looking at it the way someone from this time period looks at film. And you have to separate that. So what I did is I first came up with five things that might make a film exist outside of the present tense, like things that are the qualities that people will care about, and then try to find films that fit into it. So my answers actually are probably going to seem much more obvious than yours. I don't think there's nothing on my list that's remotely like The Happening.
Okay? Not on mine either. Like, well, so we're in the same boat there.
So the first one, the first kind of quality I thought about is the idea is the lack of a cultural shift. The idea that maybe movies, because they play this really interesting specific role in society where it is part of dating culture and people need somewhere to go on Friday and Saturday nights with someone else to sit and sort of have a passive experience that's still entertainment, that keeps them from having to talk to each other and just kind of get used to each other by being in this public setting. Part of me thinks that unlike television, movies could sort of exist as they always have in perpetuity. So if that's the case, if it's sort of a static film culture, then it's going to become a little bit like the way we look at presidents. I often use this example for things. I mean, it's like if we're talking about who is the best or the five great presidents, it doesn't matter if we're talking about it now or if we're going to talk about it in 250 years. Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, these names are always going to be in the conversation because they actually create the template for what a good president is. You can't be better than those presidents because a new president, if he is great, is sort of similar or doing the same kind of things that these presidents did. So if a culture remains static, you sort of like the first ideas of what makes something great kind of remain. So my first thing is, in this world, it probably would be Citizen Kane. Like, they would not – no one would come in and sort of upend that and the importance of that film, because it would always be seen sort of as the genesis for sophisticated filmmaking. And it will always be sort of the first part of the conversation, regardless of what comes after it.
Doesn't Kane as well, I was thinking, tie back into what you discuss in the book with Moby Dick a little bit? Is it the film equivalent of that in some ways?
Well, I mean, it didn't win the Academy Award, but it was appreciated in its time.
Not as much as it is later, yes, but definitely, you're right, it was. Certainly more than Moby Dick.
And, you know, it was formally inventive, and that's a big deal. And it, you know, one of the things I write about in the book quite a bit is that very often history is defined by people who don't really know what they're defining. In other words, the specialists and the historians, they'll have all these different arguments for what we should remember about film. But for the most part, for the middle-of-the-road mainstream society, it's kind of people who just sort of accept the conventional wisdom. And there's a lot of people who know that Citizen Kane is an important film who have not watched it.
Yeah.
And that is part of this. I mean, it's a kind of a depressing thing. It seems to separate quality from conversation, but that's part of it, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so you guys have done a great job here, and I think it's safe to say I combined some elements from everything you said, Josh, and some elements from what you described, Chuck. Though, like what you said, my list is definitely full of more picks like Citizen Kane and not with movies like The Happening. And my guiding principle really came, Chuck, from what you discuss in the book and what you discussed in a New York Times article in May that was kind of the impetus for this list. Which rock star will historians of the future remember? And you said this: as the timeline moves forward, tangential artists in any field fade from the collective radar until only one person remains. The significance of that individual is then exaggerated until the genre and the person become interchangeable. And then you go on. I imagine a college classroom in 300 years in which a hip instructor is leading a tutorial filled with students. These students relate to rock music with no more fluency than they do the music of Mesopotamia. It's a style they've learned to recognize, but just barely, and only because they've taken this specific class. Nobody in the room can name more than two rock songs except the professor. He explains the sonic structure of rock, its origins, the way it served as cultural currency, and how it shaped and defined three generations of a global superpower. He shows the class a photo, or perhaps a hologram, of an artist who has been intentionally selected to epitomize the entire concept. For these future students, that singular image defines what rock was. So I started from that point, and for the photo or that hologram image that epitomizes movies, it's more complicated in a way, because is it a frame from a movie? Is it a single shot? Is it an image that's not a person at all? Is it a director's face? I don't really think so. My guess is it would be a performer's face, and someone much more steeped in Deleuze than me will have to come on to talk about cinematic taxonomy and the close-up and the power of that. But I do know that the first image that popped into my head when I read your rock star question, Chuck, was the one you landed on, Chuck Berry. And the first image I see in my head that defines cinema, even 300 years from now, is John Wayne. And maybe you go to the tracking shot into a close-up famous introduction of him on screen as the Ringo Kid in Stagecoach. But I think movies, like any narrative construct, they're about creating myths. And nobody was more of a mythical screen presence with all that contains, all those multitudes, than Wayne. And John Ford's 1962, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, is a movie fundamentally about the power of myths. It's also a movie about fundamental human values, trying to build a society upon them. And so looking back on this generation right now from the future, or looking back on a generation raised by the generation like our fathers who grew up on Westerns and defined themselves against masculine paradigms like Wayne, I think Westerns, to go to your point, Josh, could be one of those genres that they're already pretty elevated in film critic and scholar circles. I wonder if they will actually only be further elevated 300 years from now.
Or will they be so extinct in terms of just completely dying out? We do get, like, you know, Hell or High Water right now, little revivals here or there, but maybe that will be some of the value too, in that here is a art form that once thrived that is no longer around, and that's why it's held up by a historian. That could be.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, John Wayne's a very interesting figure in this conversation, because for that to be true, for what you're arguing to be accurate, a certain cultural pendulum has to swing back in the other direction. I mean, I would say right now, the perception of John Wayne and the use of John Wayne as an example in any context outside of the films he was actually in is generally pejorative.
Mm-hmm.
That he is no longer seen as a conquering hero, but an oppressive hero.
Mm-hmm.
And it is possible now that this is a temporary thing. The way that we view this is a temporary thing. And that this will move back in the other direction. And someone like John Wayne will go from being sort of a, you know, he was a lionized figure and then sort of a criticized figure. And then he might just kind of become almost an icon with a neutral charge, and this idea of what he looked like and what he represented and the idea of Westerns then could actually be exactly what you argue. But part of me feels like if the films of John Wayne and those Westerns are remembered, they may be remembered as a way to point out historical problems.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you finish the job?
What good did that do you?
By what you preach, none. But what that Comanche believes, ain't got no eyes, he can't enter the spirit land. Has to wander forever between the winds. You get it, Reverend. Come on, blanket head.
Josh, you're number four.
All right, number four, I'm going to bend one of my guidelines here. This one is, it was a critical darling. It made both my and Adam's 2014 top 10 list, but it didn't get to the point where it broke through to any sort of wide acclaim. Under the Skin is the film, director Jonathan Glazer's sci-fi mystery about an alien who takes on the form of Scarlett Johansson and then seduces and devours unsuspecting men. This is a movie of infinite subtext. When I mentioned subtext at the top, and I wonder if the one that might speak the most loudly in 200 years, or at least maybe be seen as most reflective of our current era, is the subtext of gender identity that's going on here. It isn't, you know, I saw that it was there potentially. It's not what initially struck me most about the film. I simply thought about what it had to say in regard to body image and body image's effect on human behavior. But thinking about it a little more now in the context of your book, Chuck, and especially thinking about that climax to the movie in which we're shown the alien's genderless form, I do think the questions I asked in my initial written review also apply to these conversations that we've been having in recent years around everything from Caitlyn Jenner to an Olympic athlete like Caster Semenya. What does it mean to have a body? What do we say with the ways we use our bodies? How does our outer form shape our inner identity? I mean, these are all questions that apply not only to Under the Skin, but I suppose also something like Target bathrooms. So the fact that this movie doesn't clearly come down on any side or position in what we could call these current gender wars, I think argues in favor of its durability. It simply reflects that around the turn of the century, there was this anxiety over gender. That's one of the defining things of our era. And perhaps Under the Skin will be a prism to capture that in some way.
You're a handsome face.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, cheers.
You think I'm pretty?
I think you're gorgeous.
Do you?
Aye, definitely.
Good.
I've got a nice smile as well, whatever.
Do I?
Aye, big thing.
What about your smile?
Aye.
You have a nice smile on yourself.
Cheers.
Good.
One of the wrinkles to this list that, again, just further complicated it is defining subtext, or when you identify subtext, if it's fairly easy for you to identify as subtext, then it almost defies the notion, and maybe it is, in fact, text. I know that was something I did consider a lot. I don't know if that's a movie, Under the Skin, Chuck, that you're familiar with.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that. I didn't think it was that great. I remember when my wife liked it more than I did, but my number four, I guess, is sort of in line a little bit with the conversation we're just having now, and it's something I wrote about in the book, so if people have read the book, they will have already heard this, but I think that The Matrix is a particularly interesting film as thinking about how it could be viewed moving forward. That, you know, it was, besides being commercially successful, it was a critically appreciated film at the time it came out, but for specific reasons, for both sort of its effects and its use of CGI and bullet time and all that, but also be just because it's sort of like the mainstreaming of this idea of life being a simulation, which has become oddly like something many people are familiar with in a very short period of time, but it was very novel when this movie came out in, it was 99. But the reason I think that it could seem particularly significant in a much distant future is the fact that the people who made this film went from being men to women. And that you talk about subtext, and, you know, if something is too obviously subtextual, maybe it's text. There's also the idea of applied subtext, which is that no one thought The Matrix, when it came out, was about gender identity. That crossed no one's mind. I mean, if anybody thought this, I didn't see them write about it or hear them say it. But with all this extra knowledge we have about the makers of the film and sort of the period of time it happened in this interesting window where, you know, in 1992, there was just no sort of transgender identity in the world in any kind of extension of popular culture to where we are now, where it has completely changed. And, you know, Caitlyn Jenner can get more Twitter followers than Obama in a day. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that this happened right in the middle of that may lead someone to look at The Matrix, you know, in a distant future as a movie about this very idea. And it's always part of this, you know, when people want to go back and find historical artifacts and sort of discuss them in their present tense, they want to have the ability to create their own interpretation. Mm-hmm. They don't want to just use the old interpretation and repeat it. They want to create their own. And this allows the opportunity, you know.
Yeah, I love that example, and we did use that a lot as we were discussing with each other kind of what your book was about and what this list ultimately was going to be about. But it also does, here I am again as a broken record, prove one of the difficulties where we have had the 16 or 17 years since The Matrix for new information to come to light to now look back on that in a completely different way. Whereas if, as we initially set out, Josh, we were looking at films, really recent films, a movie like Under the Skin, for example, nothing new. There hasn't been enough time that's happened. Nothing has evolved to then look back on that with any kind of fresh perspective. So again, well, just
and also like Under the Skin, those identity issues in Under the Skin were very conscious, I assume, by the filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And like, were these ideas a conscious part for the Wachowski brothers, sisters, however you look at it? I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, because they just never talk about that stuff.
Yeah. And the difference, too, is with The Matrix, that's almost extra textual, right? You're taking
absolutely.
Things completely outside of the film rather than the text of the film itself and applying how that is going to play out in
mm-hmm.
the future.
Yeah. Okay, so my number four is a movie and an image suggested by Chuck Canzoneri, a longtime listener, one of our Film Spotting Advisory Board volunteers. And I suppose for me, it's the female counter to John Wayne in the sense that just as a pure, striking cinematic image, it's the next one that comes to mind after I think of John Wayne. It's this face forever seared on my brain, the terrified but still defiant close-up face of Maria Falconetti in Carl Theodore Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc. And going back again to that Chuck Berry article and your comments in the book, Chuck, you mentioned that teacher explaining the sonic structure of rock, its origins. I'm imagining that these students 200, 300 years from now, they've never seen a movie. Movies as we currently think of them don't mm-hmm. really exist. And you go back to this movie from 1928. This is a time where film is still certainly primarily, exclusively a visual art form. The way this movie uses light and shadow, every shot, angle, and position being employed in the confined space, the editing that doesn't really rely at all on continuity or the continuity system we'd come to define with Hollywood and mainstream movies, but on juxtaposition, the fractured psychological cutting strategy, it heightens the terror of this Inquisition. That's what the whole movie is, this Inquisition. And the visual structure of film is completely on display. So I think that alone for me is why I think if you're trying to say this is what film was, you could potentially hold up Dreyer and this movie as that example. Now, thinking about it textually or larger themes, and that may only get us into trouble, but you want to think, of course, that we live now in a much more tolerant, inclusive society than we did back in 1928. And 200 years from now, it'll be even more so. But we are, of course, as we sit in 2016, still racked by religious and spiritual strife. And I wonder if a movie like The Passion of Joan of Arc, this movie about judgment for her beliefs and that defiance, will it be a genuine curiosity? Will it be a fascinating document that people are still 200 years from now pondering over, or is it something that gets written off?
Yeah, and once you bring religion into it and try to project that 200 years out, that's a whole other can of worms. All right, this rabbit hole needs a bit more digging, so we'll be back with our final three picks for the movies historians of the future will remember. Maybe you can try to predict them in the meantime. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh. I'm Adam. Chuck Klosterman on the line with us via the Panoply Studios in Brooklyn for our special 600th episode of Film Spotting. His new book, But What If We're Wrong, inspired our top five list this week, the top five movies historians of the future will remember. Well documented in the last segment just how difficult this list was to prepare, but we're going to plow forward, Josh, and I'm curious to hear your number three.
My number three is 28 Weeks Later. This is the sequel to 28 Days Later. That was directed by Danny Boyle. This is from director Juan Carlos Fresnadillo. To my mind, this is the better film by just a bit about a rage virus that's transformed most of England's population into bloodthirsty homicidal maniacs. So this is another somewhat subtext, certainly metaphor pick, as most zombie movies are. And yes, for my purposes, let's just call this one a zombie movie. I know there's some debate over that. But if you think about this as being a time of more than 65 million refugees, okay, more than any other time since World War II, that is a significant effect on our era that perhaps will be something that's considered when people look back on it. And while there are amazing stories of such refugees being met with grace and with care, we all know that this has also been cause for a circle the wagon sort of paranoia and fear. And that's what 28 Weeks Later reflects. The majority of the movie does take place in this quarantine section of London, overseen by an American-led NATO force. And so when the virus breaks out, even in this spot, the infected get in. The movie taps into all sorts of fundamental fears of having our safe lives upended, not being able to protect our loved ones, monsters in the dark, and here's the potent one for this list, I think, of sacrificing freedom and compassion in the name of security, which I fear far off in the future is going to be a historically apt portrait of the post-9/11 global landscape.
Yeah. In fact, I think when it came out and we reviewed it on the show, I saw it completely through that prism of it's a post-9/11 movie. It's an Iraq war catastrophe movie.
That's my initial impression as well, as less the refugee thing and more Iraq war.
Yeah, so you're right. That's a different perspective.
Definitely allegories going on
we
here.
We put on it now. And a movie I loved, my co-host at the time, Sam, not a big fan of that movie. We had a little bit of a knockdown dragout. That's a bold statement, though, Josh, to put it ahead of the Danny Boyle.
Oh, I think it is. Yeah, I just love how it develops some of those ideas.
All right. Chuck?
Well, first of all, I have one quick question, follow-up on that. Mm-hmm. Who debates whether or not this is a zombie movie? What is the argument?
Oh, man.
Oh, don't open that one.
Way too many of our listeners. Way too many,
okay,
Chuck.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Okay, because the thing I was going to add to that is that, you know, monster movies in general typically have sort of an established metaphor that goes with them. Mm-hmm. I mean, vampires and disease, you know, and Frankenstein and the idea of playing God. Godzilla, those type of things, science gone too far.
Right.
Zombies are interesting. I mean, like the werewolf, I guess, is like getting back to the natural state. But the zombie is interesting because it seems open to interpretation over what zombies are supposed to signify. There is something more modern about the concept of a zombie, even though the idea for zombies goes way, way back. I think it might be kind of an interesting pick because it allows people to sort of project onto that film what zombies are supposed to exemplify about society.
Yeah.
I feel like that's still open for debate, where it's not really with like the idea of vampires.
No, that's a great point.
Very malleable figures, yeah.
What about your number three, your next pick, Chuck?
Okay, I kind of cheated. I have two on this one. Is that okay?
Yeah. Okay. Hey, I mean, okay. I've never done it in 600 episodes. I never cheat, so, but I suppose we'll allow it.
For the third one, I thought about the idea of ancillary significance. The idea of a movie becoming timeless and historically important for reasons outside of the idea of it as a movie, but as its connection to something else, okay? And the two movies that I thought of in this category, one was A Hard Day's Night, that it seems very plausible to me, even though I kind of argue against it in one part of the book, but, you know, in a reasonable world, the idea of the Beatles will exist, you know, maybe even more prominently than the very idea of rock music in the future. I think it's possible in a distant future where rock music is only remembered as the thing the Beatles happen to do. So if the Beatles have that kind of significance, people will go to A Hard Day's Night. And even though, you know, that movie was written by a guy, it's like, his name was Olin Owen, I think his name was. He came up with the idea of what the Beatles' personalities would be like. And yet somehow they actually became those people. Like the way we think of John Lennon's personality and George Harrison's personality, they seem to be synthesized and distilled in A Hard Day's Night, even though they were playing themselves but saying other people's words. Mm-hmm. But that really built the idea of these four characters.
Hey, pardon me for asking, but who's that little old man?
What little old man?
That little old man.
Oh, that one, that's my grandfather.
Your grandfather?
Yeah.
That's not your grandfather.
It is, you know.
But I've seen your grandfather. He lives in your house.
Oh, that's my other grandfather, but he's my grandfather as well.
How do you reckon that one out?
Well, everyone's entitled to two, aren't they? And it's my other one.
We know that, but what's he doing here?
Well, my mother thought a trip would do him good.
How's that?
He's nursing a broken heart.
Ah, poor old thing. Hey, mister, are you nursing a broken heart? He's a nice old man, isn't he?
He's very clean.
I think that if there is a memory of the Beatles, that movie becomes more important as a way sort of into that legacy. And the other movie that is, I guess, in some ways, you know, less known, but the 1979 movie Over the Edge. And the reason I bring this up is because, okay, let's work from the premise that we believe in the future people look back and still kind of talk about the importance of Nirvana, and that Nirvana created a cultural shift in the 90s, and that the release of Nevermind was really when the 80s ended. And a lot of the kind of the cultural aesthetics and ideas of the 80s ended, and we moved into sort of a different era. If we accept that, we look at Kurt Cobain and say he's very important, okay? And when you look at, say, the Nirvana B-side collection, Incesticide, at one point in the liner notes, Kurt Cobain specifically says he just wanted his band to be like Cheap Trick. And if you watch Over the Edge, in a time when music licensing obviously was not enforced the way it is now, there's tons of Cheap Trick songs, okay? And Kurt Cobain on many occasions has mentioned how Over the Edge was his favorite movie, how he watched it endlessly growing up before he was too young, you know, to even really understand what it was about, which suggests to me that's where he was introduced to Cheap Trick. So that movie introduced Kurt Cobain to the band he wanted to eventually become, which became Nirvana, which sort of had a big sweeping impact going forward.
Wow.
So you can kind of like trace backwards and find a movie that for reasons unrelated to itself became very important.
Yeah.
You've won the top five by making a pick of a film that I was completely unfamiliar with.
Now, see, I grew up, the only thing that
you knew Over the Edge?
That Kurt Cobain and I have in common is that we both watched Over the Edge several times as young kids and didn't get it at all.
See, now, where did you see it? Where were you watching this? Was it on HBO early on or something?
Yep.
Had to be HBO, right?
I'm pretty sure it was on HBO. Would have been the early 80s. I would have been in grade school. And at the time watching it, it was a film I truly couldn't comprehend. Like, I was watching it through that haze of a 8 or 10-year-old kid from a small town in Iowa who was like, why are these kids so angry? What are they so rebellious and fired up about that they're destroying their school? I could not comprehend it at all. So,
and it's interesting to watch that movie because the movie that's the easiest comparison would be Kids, right? That's like the closest comparison. But when Kids came out, I think that was, 95 or 94, you watch that movie, or I did at least, and in the theater, I went on a first date to that movie, which was a very weird first date, I remember. But it was like, well, are these what kids are like, or are these what kids could be like in the worst possible circumstance? There was sort of a debate over whether or not there are really kids like this, or if this is sort of a worst case scenario. Where in Over the Edge, if you go back and watch it now, it seems perhaps more realistic than it did in 79.
I could see that.
Because it sort of reminded me of the late 70s more than kids reminds me of the mid-90s. Hmm.
Welcome to New Granada, where people come to escape city life. It has safe streets, clean air, good schools. It's a perfectly planned community. But something strange is happening. Something that wasn't part of the plan.
Seems to me like you all were in such a hopped-up hurry to get out of the city that you turn your kids into exactly what you're trying to get away from.
Something that could drive this town over the edge.
You were to take these home to your parents. It's to let them know about a special emergency meeting to discuss the problems about your people. Mommy's
all right. The kid who tells on another kid. It's a dead kid. Oh!
So my number three, another movie I watched probably about the same time, maybe a little bit earlier before I watched Over the Edge, and it opens with this challenge to future historians and us doing this list. For nearly 40 years, this story has given faithful service to the young in heart, and time has been powerless to put its kindly philosophy out of fashion. This is a movie from 1939. The Wizard of Oz, and 39 was a hallowed year in cinema, still very highly regarded. Gone with the Wind, Ninotchka, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Stagecoach, and of course, The Wizard of Oz. And saying all that just makes me think that this is obviously a terrible pick because it's such an obvious one. But going back before two or three decades before The Passion of Joan of Arc, the very earliest cinema, you look at the Roundhay Garden scene or the Lumiere brothers, workers leaving a factory, film at its core was humanity, was reality reflected back to us. And I think about The Wizard of Oz as this movie within the movie of sorts, the journey to Oz and back in color. Dorothy seeing her world reflected back to her in the form of these characters and these moments from her life and her reckoning with the present through this imagined world. And of course, the fundamental content, too, good versus evil, characters seeking a heart, a brain, courage. Dorothy's story over the years itself has been appropriated as a political allegory. It's been turned into an allegory about adolescence. It's just so elemental and narratively sound that I feel like any generation may be able to find in it whatever that generation needs to find in The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, I think that's a really good pick for the same reason I had used Citizen Kane, but going back to what you had mentioned earlier with John Wayne, how it might just be an image, you know, the scene where Dorothy opens the door and it goes from black and white to color almost seems to be like an allegory for what film is supposed to do in general.
Yeah.
That there is a limit to the world and the world is suddenly limitless. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could see that scene being the thing that people identify as what film was, particularly, let's say, there's a world where maybe film does to a degree recede from the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of talked about in classrooms, like we were talking about rock music. I think that, you know, you have 10 seconds there, you know, and to a degree, The Wizard of Oz has been damaged a little bit by cable television. Because when I was growing up, The Wizard of Oz was on once a year.
Yep.
And it's, everyone watched it. Everyone who was a little kid watched it, and you waited for it, and it made that movie seem extremely significant.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, I feel like that's a very easy movie to see, and that has made it less meaningful. But if cable had not proliferated, I wonder what the meaning of The Wizard of Oz would still be.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I've talked about it on the show. Same for me, and I suppose a lot of people of our age range here, it was on TV once a year. Early cinematic memory has nothing to do with going to a cinema. It was just watching that with my family every year for probably 5 or 6 years in a row at least.
Well, and that's another wrinkle that comes into making a list like this is how is the viewing technology or habits alone, how are those going to affect what we value when we look back at films from an earlier era? And I think that comes – technology certainly comes into play in my number two pick. I'm also realizing that different from the two of you, I did try to stick with films pretty much from 2000 on that may speak particularly to this era less than the idea of cinema itself. And that's definitely true of this pick at number two. Unfriended, the 2015 horror film that takes place entirely on the computer desktop of a teen girl who's video chatting with her friends. So again here, how technology informs our consumption of the movies themselves. All we see in Unfriended is her laptop screen, essentially. Now, while they're online, this group is joined by an anonymous caller who claims to be a friend of theirs. In fact, the same friend who killed herself a year earlier after a particularly cruel instance of cyberbullying. So, you know, you might think maybe I'll make this pick because it speaks to the phenomenon of bullying, but there's something broader going on here that maybe will have more relevance over the long haul is this idea of personal technology at the turn of the century. Unfriended isn't just a horror movie. It's not just about teen bullying. As an aesthetic concept, as an experience, it really does capture how we've come to use technology to fracture our experience of everyday reality, not alter that experience, but fracture it, like break it apart until it virtually becomes meaningless. If you haven't seen this, consider, I'll kind of describe it a little bit for listeners too, what's simultaneously taking place on this one computer screen over the course of the movie, all these windows and apps that are open at the same time. The girl's watching video of the suicide, which they have from someone's camera phone. She also has video of the bullying incident that prompted it. This ongoing Skype call with her friends is taking place in the background. Then she has a private side chat where she's conducting with her boyfriend. Facebook notifications are dinging in, one of them claiming to be from the dead friend. And then, you know, because that's not enough, there's a little Spotify music in the background. So I think the filmmakers are really clever visually evoking this theme of fracturing. And who knows what personal communication technology is going to be like in 250 years. But for historians of that time, this little shocker is going to provide a pretty fascinating glimpse of what it looks like now.
I still need to see it.
Yeah, it's not. It's also, it has, yeah, there's a few fright moments, but it's really more just this bizarre viewing experience that's at once familiar and completely off kilter.
Yeah, one movie I almost put on this list but didn't. But I would have, for the same reasons you just described, was the movie Existence.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, the Cronenberg.
Yeah, the Cronenberg movie with Jude Law.
Yep.
Because to me, when I initially saw that film, there's a couple scenes particularly where I was sort of just blown away by how they took video game logic and the things that happen when you're playing an immersive video game and kind of made them into these kind of human characters or whatever. Now, I saw the film again. I don't know if it was this year or last year, and it seemed less good. I guess maybe because I was no longer shocked by these things,
mm-hmm.
So I almost watched it more like a regular movie. But this idea is obviously, this is the defining question kind of this period, the intersection of life and technology. I do wonder maybe if, because, you know, like you're describing this film and I haven't seen it either, but I did think to myself, like, that sounds good, but like in 10 years, will it seem like Sandra Bullock's The Net?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, will it seem, you know, and will it need to be, for a film to really explain or sort of get into the problems with technology, will it have to be a non-technology film? A film about something else that is then applied to the idea of technology. In other words, people interacting in sort of a conventional way, maybe even a way, you know, maybe even a period piece, but the problems that they'll be dealing with in the 1700s or whatever will somehow be like illustrative of the complexity of technology, because you don't got to worry about the details seeming out of date.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's something like Unfriended will absolutely be dated. It already is in some ways, just a year later. But one reason I did like it is because it does avoid what you're talking about, Chuck, in that there's not this narrative of a character sort of where technology is part of their larger story. Like, the technology is the experience of watching the movie. I'm sure there are other things somewhat like it. In fact, there was like a first-person shooter movie that came out just this year where the entire film is from the video game player's perspective, I believe, something like that. I haven't seen that one. I can't recall the name. But I think something like this, where your actual viewing experience is the technology itself and the narrative is secondary works a little bit differently.
Yeah, no, that's a great explanation. Chuck, what about your number two?
Okay, for my number two, I'm going to explain my reasoning, and then I want you two guys to give what your answer would be, and then I'll give mine.
Okay.
Okay, I was thinking about the idea of film as history, a significant historical event that, as we get further and further from it, will be most remembered by its film adaptation. So that if the event itself, because it's part of actual history, people will care about, anybody wanting to understand it or get a sense of it will actually go to the film interpretation of it as the main text for its memory. Like, are there any historical events or situations that you think the film will become the main text for this memory?
I got one.
Okay.
JFK.
Okay.
I like JFK. I would throw in there Spielberg's Lincoln, but I will also say my real answer is going to be my number one, so I'll hold off on that.
Wow.
Well, my answer is a movie that I don't like, but I think will fit this criteria, which is Titanic.
Yeah.
That it seems as though that now that movie has become the go-to description of what happened, you know. And so this is an event that people knew about before this movie ever came out, obviously. The Titanic was something that I learned about very early in grade school. I can imagine a time where a third or fourth grader learning about Titanic is shown Titanic in class. The other examples I thought of, All the President's Men, possibly. Could that become more important than the actual book about Watergate? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
A weird one was, as we become a more secular culture and fewer kids are sort of indoctrinated into religion, or Judeo-Christian religion, at least the way I was and a lot of other people were, will the movie The Ten Commandments become sort of the way people know about and understand this pretty fundamental idea about morality?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one makes a lot of sense.
It does. Those are so great, all three of them. Yeah. My number two, first, I do have a quick correction because I know listeners are going to write in the scene with Mark Wahlberg going back to the first segment.
Right.
Not Jane Alexander, Betty Buckley.
Okay.
Of course, the actress in that scene.
There
okay,
you go.
But moving on, I think this will
so
tie
you have
in.
You have a real aggressive listenership, huh? They really hold your feet to the fire, huh?
So
that's a pretty minor
that, huh?
thing to get wrong.
That's it? you pretty much defined, you summed up 600 episodes here so concisely. But I think this will tie in, Josh, with what you were saying a little bit with Unfriended, and we're talking about technology in the sense that Chuck, you've been talking recently, and I think you may get into this in the book a little bit, but I also could be blurring other things I've read and other things I've heard. I know you talked about it on WTF with Mark Maron. Our need right now for shared experiences, right? We look at the emotional outpouring, all the bonding that seems to happen when celebrities pass away. And you describe that as that's the only way people know we're all having the same emotional exchange at the same time. So that's in my head. And then, again, I'm watching the new Herzog film, and that same cosmologist Lawrence Krauss has this really provocative line at the end of the film. He says, will our children's children's children need the companionship of humans, or will they have evolved in a world where that's not important? It sounds awful, doesn't it? But maybe it will be fine. Maybe the companionship of robots, maybe the companionship of an intelligent internet will be sufficient. Who am I to say? So what I love there is the way Krauss, he even has to immediately provide the disclaimer. It sounds awful, doesn't it? Because any of us listening to that, I think we've all been programmed, not the right word, but we all understand that, well, life is all about connection and intimacy and these shared experiences with other people. And Krauss at least throws out there the idea that maybe that conventional wisdom really isn't valid at all. And that isn't how these future generations are going to exist. And it's simply, and it won't be bad. Like, we look at it as almost this dystopian thing if everyone is just plugged into their device, like in Her, maybe with Joaquin Phoenix. Krauss is at least allowing for the fact that maybe that won't be so bad. So that all said, I even think about these shared experiences and the emotional bonding that happens. It's also happening primarily on social media. So it's most of the time with people we've all never met and likely will never meet. So in a way, they might as well not exist. So at some point, is it even still a shared human experience? As technology advances, I think those questions about what constitutes a human experience and whether they matter obviously are only going to get more difficult to answer. And so maybe a movie like Her or a movie like Moon the Duncan Jones film with Sam Rockwell, maybe that will be elevated, or maybe it will be completely the opposite. It will be a movie with only this to offer in the form of modern technology. A 411 Positrac Outback, 750 double pumper, Edelbrock intake, board over 30, 11-to-1 pop-up pistons, turbojet 390 horsepower. I'm talking about Dazed and Confused, the Richard Linklater movie. So a lot of ways you could go with Linklater, who does make an appearance in your book, Chuck, and I know you're generally a fan of his work. And it's tempted to go with maybe the trippier stuff, something like A Scanner Darkly or Waking Life or even Slacker for a list like this. Or maybe something that is really fundamentally about the passage of time and these movies unfolding in a sort of real time, like movie frames running through a projector, creating the illusion of time passing, whether it's Boyhood or the Before trilogy. But I went to Dazed and Confused because in some ways, going back to what you said, Chuck, just a bit ago, it's in a way it's about technology in the sense that it's about the absence of technology. So I'm going with a movie that perhaps foresaw in some ways the coming onslaught of the internet and our growing disconnection from each other back in 1993, and it took us to a time and a place where the shared human experience was everything, whether you're hanging out in cars or you're at the Emporium or the field by the Moonlight Tower or you're getting high on the 50-yard line and then taking off to go get Aerosmith tickets so you can watch Joe Perry and Steven Tyler perform Sweet Emotion with 20,000 of your best friends.
All those specifics, that's what I wonder, does that work against it? Like, is this just too much of a time capsule that it gets
maybe
one particular era so perfectly right for a certain segment of the population, at least.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, but as you go further and further away from the film, everything arguably becomes too specific. So the actual heightened specificity might be better.
Yep.
Mm. Like, you know, there's no film that you can make where you'll be like, well, these references will still make sense in 100 years.
Sure.
You know, so you might as well go the other way. I got to say, that's an incredibly creative way of looking at that movie. I have never thought of Dazed and Confused as a way to think about the internet or whatever, but that it's very interesting to me. I always viewed that movie sort of as like the difference between how something happened and how you remember the event happening.
Yeah.
So like when they show 1976, that's kind of the way somebody who was a senior that year would remember what the parties were like. All the music they're playing is from 76. Everyone's wearing bell bottoms. You know, everybody is sort of an extension of that period, almost a caricature of that period. And it probably wasn't actually like that, but that's how you remember it. Now, I don't know how that plays into sort of its ability to sort of exist beyond itself. But, you know, I mean, Linklater's films are very, very interesting for this way. Like I saw, you know, there's that top 100 list that came out on the BBC, the first, you know, best 100 films of the 21st century. And there were several of his films in there. So Boyhood was very high. There were a few other that were, you know, that kind of surprised me. It's like his movies, because in many ways they're simpler. Like
yes.
They're, you know, that they do seem to change less as time passes. I guess you could say Slacker might be a way to understand the 90s in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way the characters in that movie look at life is what I remember about what the 90s were like, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely. Well, I probably just should have stopped there, but alas, we have one more pick. So, Josh, the number one, in your mind, movie historians of the future will remember.
So this ties a little bit into what you were saying, Chuck, about film as history with your number two, your Titanic pick, although it takes that idea and then veers in a different direction. This is a bit of a cheat. Adam's the one who likes to cheat and his picks on our list, but if I'm ever going to do it, I'm going to do it on an abstract list like this one. So bear with me here. I think the number one movie historians from the future will remember could very well be some sort of collection of amateur videos of unarmed African-American citizens being shot and killed by police. Now, before I get to the subject matter, let me back up and say that we can be fairly sure of, and this is something you talk about a little bit in the book, Chuck, that movies as we understand them won't look like our movies of today, okay? How we view them, how they function, how they operate, all those things are going to be different. So we can maybe start to guess at what they might look like, and perhaps it will be something like these amateur citizen videos. Maybe these offer a model. These are crowdsourced, they're viral, they're driven by affordable and available technology. So beyond all that aspect of it, I'm not sure that a dramatized depiction of this sort of injustice, which has, you know, been going on forever in this country, but's gained particular prominence in the national conversation in recent years. I don't know that a dramatization of that or an adaptation like you were talking about, Chuck, might speak to it as strongly in the future, even if it's a really solid movie. Okay, something like Fruitvale Station, perhaps. It seems like some version of the videos themselves could be more potent. Now, I was playing around with this idea in my head. I didn't know if it made much sense, but then I saw that friend of the show, Peter Labuza, devoted a recent episode of his Cinephiliacs podcast to just these sort of videos, as well as police body camera footage, considering them how they work as aesthetic objects, not just social justice avenues. So there's something of, you know, artifact as art going on here, but that's going to be my pick, these amateur videos. Mm.
So you're imagining kind of a movie that doesn't exist yet. Somebody would compile. Yeah. Okay.
A little bit. Yeah. So that's part of the cheat too, is like I'm picking something that's not really there.
Or maybe it is.
I'm imagining that something like it will be there.
Yeah. Or maybe it is and we haven't discovered
right.
it yet.
Right. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Chuck.
Okay, my number one answer is probably less fun, and to people listening to this, particularly if they're the kind of people who get very upset over your inability to point out the correct actress in The Happening, will be like, I didn't need a guy to come in and tell me this. But, you know, as I said earlier, history is generally defined by people who don't really know what they're defining. I worked at a college newspaper, and the staff, the editorial staff, we've still remained friends, you know, years later, basically through emails. And there's a woman who was an editor, who once mentioned, kind of casually, but to the surprise of everyone else, that she had never seen any Star Wars movie. She had never seen a minute of it. She had never had an interest of it. She, like me, was born in 72, and that was a possible thing to happen. Like, I saw those movies, but it would be possible for someone my age to at one point feel like they're a little too old. Maybe they've missed the first one, so they didn't see Empire, no interest in Jedi, you know, just kind of miss it entirely. So we were all kind of amazed by this. But then she was like, I feel like I know everything about him, though. And we gave her a quiz. The rest of us gave her a quiz of 10 questions about Star Wars. Things like, what is a Wookiee? What is the Force? All of these things. She got 10 right. She got all of them right. She was able to know all of these things, having never seen these movies. And to me, this is defining the idea of someone who basically says, I don't care about this, and I still know everything about it. And as a consequence, I think in a reasonable world, Star Wars is the most likely answer here. I mean, it's the movie that's bigger than movies. It's a movie that's also toys. It's a movie that's also a missile defense program.
Yeah.
It's like, it's, you know, it's a movie that has all of these things beyond itself that movies don't need to exist for people to know what it is. It is the biggest movie that there ever was. And while we're, you know, we'd like to argue that, like, well, you know, as time passes, you know, commercial qualities will matter less. That's true, I think, except at the very apex. You know, I mean, the two biggest movies of all time, in truth, are Star Wars and Gone with the Wind. But Gone with the Wind, because it basically deals with the Civil War without really talking about the black experience to any meaningful degree, is not going to be something that people are going to look back on as a way to sort of think about that period. Whereas Star Wars, because it happens in a different galaxy, in a future that's the past or a past that's the future, however you want to describe it, a lot of the issues just disappear. Also, the one thing I will say is, you know, now and moving forward forever, all special effects are CGI. So I do think that there's going to be a slight elevation of the last era of films where the effects were done mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you look at, you know, what George Lucas did in those films, those are pretty good effects. Now, the problem being that he's then changed in the movies now, so I think a lot of those mechanical effects have been lost. But in, you know, at some point, I think they'll be available again, or maybe not. Maybe he'll never allow them to be available again. Yeah. But that's kind of my cliche answer, that probably if I had to literally put $100,000 bet down on what will be remembered in 100 years, that's what I would pick.
I would not take that bet. You're right.
You're tapping into the power of myth too, right? It is partly why Star Wars, even after all its imitators and yes, technological developments in terms of effects, still speaks to people, is that it does have that power of myth behind it as well.
And not to turn this into any kind of referendum on the latest film, but despite what anyone took apart with that movie in terms of it seeming like it was too beholden to that original film or that it wasn't doing anything new and fresh with the material, I mean, we tried to argue anyway, Josh, that that's exactly what Abrams recognized was the power of that myth and tapped into it in a way that that people really obviously responded to. My number one, I'm going to set up here with a clip.
They say we only use a fraction of our brain's true potential. Now, that's when we're awake. When we're asleep, our mind can do almost anything.
Such as?
Well, imagine you're designing a building, right? You consciously create each aspect. But sometimes it feels like it's almost creating itself, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, like I'm discovering it.
Genuine inspiration, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in a dream, our mind continuously does this. We create and perceive our world simultaneously, and our mind does this so well that we don't even know what's happening. That allows us to get right in the middle of that process.
How?
By taking over the creating part. Now, this is where I need you. You create the world of the dream. We bring the subject into that dream, and they fill it with their subconscious.
How could I ever acquire enough detail to make them think that it's reality?
Well, dreams, they feel real while we're in them, right? It's only when we wake up that we realize something was actually strange.
A clip there, obviously, from Christopher Nolan's Inception. In the book, Chuck, you talk about how future generations will look back on 9/11, obviously, as this defining cultural moment that will see art through that prism, but the art that surrounds 9/11 that will be viewed as important will likely be the art, and we've touched on this throughout this top five, will be the art that has nothing directly to do with 9/11 because these cultural curators of the future, they're going to look back, they need something to decode, something to ascribe meaning to. So maybe it's Infinite Jest that becomes the defining 9/11 book. Whatever it is, it definitely won't be, as you argue, extremely loud and incredibly close. Analogous film would be, it won't be probably World Trade Center, or it's not going to be Paul Greengrass's United 93. Now, I say all that not because I'm setting up an argument that Inception might be the 9/11 movie of the future, though, of course, who knows? Maybe it will be. I suppose a more obvious safe bet would be The Dark Knight here. What I'm doing is just co-opting the reasoning that maybe our teacher of the future will think the best way to get her students to truly understand what movies were would be to show them a movie that on the surface has absolutely nothing to do with making a movie, and yet simultaneously and really elegantly deconstructs the process of both being a filmmaker and being a film viewer. The line that DiCaprio has, genuine inspiration, right? That's what every director is seeking, what every artist is seeking. DiCaprio is that director in this movie. How could I ever acquire enough detail to make them think it's reality? That's Ellen Page. She's the screenwriter that he's recruiting to create the world of the dream slash movie. And that last bit, dreams, they feel real while we're in them, right? Movies, when they are at their best, when we feel like we're discovering them along with the filmmakers, they feel real while we're in them too. It's only when the lights turn on that we realize that something was strange. Inception's my number one.
I like it. There's so many angles to that film as well. Visual, literal angles to that film.
Yes.
But interpretive ones too. That it's it's a smart pick.
Yeah, it's well described, the way you described why it's meaningful as a 9/11 film. That is something we didn't really talk about in this podcast. I wonder how much the memory of 9/11 will impact the memory of film from this period. To me, the 9/11 film, when the defining one, is Cloverfield. And what's odd about Cloverfield is they actually basically replicate shots that we saw from the incident. So it might be kind of what you were talking about earlier, subtext that's actually text. Like there are scenes in Cloverfield that are not reminiscent of 9/11. They're actual attempts. There's one in a store where you see all the dust move by.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I saw that shot on the news. The idea of Inception being in this category, though, is new to me, although as you describe it, it makes a lot of sense. Not as a 9/11 movie, but in the same way that this works.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are our top five movies historians of the future will remember. Chuck, obviously, as I've noted, maybe the most nervous I've ever been or the most intense of a preparation process I've ever had for a top five list, but it was a lot of fun. Actually exceeded my expectations.
Yeah, you didn't seem nervous at all.
Okay, well, I'm a very good actor.
You should have told me that.
Once I get on mic, I'm a good actor. So Chuck Listerman, his new book, But What If We're Wrong, is out now wherever you buy books. Thanks so much for doing this,
Thank you, Chuck.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, you know what's much, much easier than predicting the future? Reflecting on the past. To help us celebrate the 600th episode, listeners and hosts share their defining film spotting moments when we come back. Stay with us.
Last night, I dreamed my birthday. There were two of you. One who stayed, one who went away. Last night I dreamed of you. Last night I dreamed New Year's Eve. You were old and new. Time tumbled down, a new one was crowned. Last night I dreamed anew.
This is David L. Williams from Central Pennsylvania. The defining moment of film spotting for me came when the show wasn't even called Film Spotting yet. 11 years ago, Cinecast episode 25 about Gus Van Sant's last days, quote, "I was eager for the film to get over so I could just declare it a masterpiece." When I heard that, I knew that these people were my people. I've listened to every episode since. Happy 600th.
A fantastic voicemail there from a fantastic longtime listener of the show, David L. Williams. And that line about Last Days, one of the early movies we reviewed on the show, Gus Van Sant's film about Kurt Cobain, that is just prototypical Sam. One of those lines I would never think to say on the show. And actually, that's a running theme as we get through some of this feedback here. Josh, the co-hosts have always been the smarter and more clever.
Oh, come
hosts.
On now.
No.
Don't be so self-deprecating already.
The evidence speaks for itself. Thank you, David, for that. We will get to some more voicemails and a lot more feedback here as we do reflect on 600 episodes, 11 and a half years of film spotting. And we've done this a bit over the years, so we don't want to belabor it too much, but we've had some of these milestone episodes, and we went back and looked at what the topics were for those shows. Episode number 100, Sam and I did a two-part episode where we shared our all-time favorite male and female comedic and dramatic performances, and we got Dylan Kidd, the writer-director of Roger Dodger, a favorite of ours at the time and still, to come on the show, and he shared his picks as well. Of course, the great humor of this is doing a list that expansive when we were only 100 episodes into the show.
Ambitious.
I mean, so ignorant though, at the time. No, I mean, we had no business putting together a top five like that. Certainly did not have any authority if we have any authority now. But that one was fun. On number 200, Maddie had only been on the show for about 25 episodes, and yet we did our film spotting discovery. So movies that we came to because of the show that
okay.
we might not otherwise have seen if it wasn't for the show. Episode number 300, of course, was the epic top 20 films of the decade, where Maddie and I brought back Sam to be part
nice.
Of that list. And then episode 400, our first live show.
Yeah,
Josh.
We went live for that one.
Yeah, we did. And we shared the top five things we learned from the movies. We may have a little bit more on that in a bit. Episode 500 a few summers ago, was our big live show at the Music Box. We had Ryan Johnson joined us via Skype on the big screen, and of course Michael Phillips and Dana Stevens were part of that as well. So that kind of brings us up to date, and we can get into some of this feedback here, starting with a note that we got, Josh, from Josh Veith in Madison, Wisconsin, and he decided to seek out if there was some way he could get a complete list of every movie that had been reviewed on Film Spotting, and he couldn't find it in one place anyway, mm-hmm. the ratings and they're there in various pages at filmspotting.net. So he says, since there was no such thing, I created one myself. I enjoyed making it, and hopefully fellow fans of the show will enjoy viewing it. Also, though it wasn't intended, think of this as my 600th episode present. So on Letterboxd, he started a list called Film Spotting Reviews, The Complete List. We will link to it in our show notes. And it does contain, this was before episode 599, so it's grown since. But when he posted this list, 996 movies.
Oh, man.
Been reviewed over these 600 episodes on Film Spotting.
That's impressive. That is quite a project. Thanks for doing that, Josh. We also got this note from Dave in Norfolk, Nebraska. I've been listening to the show since very early on, maybe May 2005. I think the Sin City review was one of the first I listened to, and I was hooked. I really liked that movie, so agreed with Adam pretty much completely. But it was Sam's criticism of the film that made me rethink my opinion in a pretty significant way. All of a sudden, I found myself feeling a little uncomfortable with how many of the women in the film were portrayed, which didn't cross my mind initially. How great to have a free show that could challenge me and be so entertaining. The show has changed how I view film and has introduced me to countless films I otherwise would not have heard about. Through graduate school, internship, marriage, divorce, another marriage, three kids, and a career, Film Spotting has been there. Thank you for all you do. It is amazing.
So we are highlighting or allowing listeners to highlight some of their favorite Film Spotting reviews. The Sin City review has come up many times over the years on these types of anniversary episodes because it was only five episodes in, but it was our first disagreement. And I'm with Dave. I disagreed with Sam, and I think we had an engaging dialogue about it. I saw the movie very differently, but that whole line of questioning that Sam had opened my eyes in many ways as well. And I think Sam over the years has really often been the conscience of the show. And he started that, I think, with that Sin City episode. We also heard from Sam from Sydney, aka a whole nother donor. And in his email, I have to note this, the name that comes through when he sends the email is Samuel J. Fletcher Esquire. I know what you're doing there. I know that that's a Fletch reference, Sam. I just want to acknowledge that. I can't actually remember what my first episode was, Sam writes. I think it was either The Social Network or Black Swan. It doesn't matter which one, as both of those reviews had me hooked right away because it was wonderful to hear such in-depth, thoughtful analysis of movies. What always meant more to me, though, wasn't just that you guys were insightful and reflective, but that even while you were looking really deeply into the framing of a scene or the nuances of a performance, you never took yourselves too seriously, and the lighthearted tone of the show has been what's kept me hooked. At the time when I was discovering you and other podcasts, I was walking an hour each way through a broken down industrial estate to a job that I hated, and Film Spotting always put me in a better mood, reminding me through your good-natured humor that life and the world wasn't all gloomy. I actually found it a very therapeutic listen at the time, and the most depressing thing about my walk to and from work was the fact that each Film Spotting episode would only really last one day of the week. 6 years later, a much better job, and having become a tiny part of Film Spotting culture myself through my criticism of Josh's grammar, that's the whole nother reference, it's still an enthusiastically anticipated part of every week. And even though I've fallen far, far behind in my film watching, I still love listening to every review and hearing what you're saying, even when you're completely wrong. Congrats to everyone involved with the show on reaching 600 episodes, and here's to 600 more.
Well, thank you, Sam, and thank you for burrowing into my head so that every time I say that now, I will feel terrible.
You know, along the lines of what he mentioned there, though, and I think I have to give Sam mostly credit for this. I think it was his line. We did set out, or maybe we didn't set out, but we recognized after doing a few dozen episodes of this show that it was really only going to work. And the only real way we could approach it is if we took film really seriously, but never took ourselves too seriously. And I hope we've lived up to that over 600 episodes. With you guys thinking back on what has stood out to you over the years as far as reviews or top five lists or whatever it may be, we also took a little bit of time to do that as well. And it's very hard because there have been so many reviews, 1,000 movies that have been reviewed over the years. But I suppose, Josh, for me, the one that really does always stand out is Take Shelter, where not only did Dana Stevens and I talk about that movie, and I felt like I talked about it in a personal way that maybe I didn't see from other critics, but then in the bonus content, we got into the end of that movie, an ending that befuddled a lot of people, including me originally. And it was really rewarding. I didn't set out to try to come up with the definitive take on that movie or anything, and I'm not sure I have, but I was just trying to wrestle with something that really unnerved me in a way. And I think that's part of what Nichols is trying to do there, but it also seemed to upend everything the movie had done up to that point. And over the course of talking with Dana about it, I felt like I came to some closure there, much like the characters, I think, in that movie do. And hearing from listeners later about how helpful that was, how they were in a similar state as me and were maybe thinking, what did he do to his movie? I don't like this movie anymore. And I was with it for most of its running time. After hearing my take on it, a lot of people did say, I see it. I see exactly what you're arguing, and I think it's a brilliant film. So that was rewarding.
Yeah, there's a distinction there between having the movie explained to you and have a clear, obvious ending and feeling, that's a great word, closure. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can bring some critical closure to your experience of the film, that helps a lot. And that's one that, listeners do bring up, mm-hmm. that review and that Take Shelter bonus content particularly.
Yeah. I think two others I'll just highlight. The Master is one we really wrestled with and I really wrestled with, and it allowed me to see Paul Thomas Anderson's work in a way that I hadn't up to that point. I was able to kind of look back during the course of that review at the dominant themes that I think emerged in his work. And I would highlight as well another one that listeners have mentioned. They go back to, and this shocks me, some listeners say they go back and they listen to this specific review, and it's the review of my number one film of the year it came out, Never Let Me Go. And the irony of that is, and I've maybe mentioned this before, that was actually kind of a terrible recording. And Maddie would totally cop to that. We taped that, Josh. That show had to be done to air on WBEZ Saturday night. And obviously the podcast has always gone up on Fridays. But Maddie was sick. I'd had a really tough week just in terms of stress. We didn't tape that episode until Saturday morning. And Maddie was still under the weather and was on medication. And during the review, he didn't like the movie. And he basically said, I fell asleep during it. And he was being critical of it because he didn't like it. But the reality is he fell asleep,
yeah,
because he was under the weather. And I don't think we had quite the engaging discussion that we could have had, but I still engage with the movie in a very meaningful way. And it was a very meaningful movie to me. And apparently it came through because, again, I've heard about that one a lot over the years.
Probably good I wasn't there for that one because I'm not a huge fan of that movie either.
I haven't
revisited it, so no. I do need to do that.
So let's get to one more take on a favorable film spotting review. This comes to us via voicemail from Anderson.
Hey, Josh and Adam, this is Anderson in Little Rock, Arkansas, calling with what I think is one of the defining moments of film spotting, and that's your review of The Tree of Life. You came at it from an intellectual perspective, and you talked about the fundamentals, but you also talked about your emotional reactions to the movie. And at the time, that meant a lot to me, because I had to drive an hour and a half to see it, and I had this otherworldly feeling about it. And it really validated my opinions of it. And I think that's what you bring to your show every week. And that's a love of movies. And I don't know. It fuels the 600 and it makes me excited for every episode you have coming up. So thanks.
Thank you, Anderson. Yeah, the Tree of Life review was a daunting one. And that leads to another sort of defining moment over the years for me, getting an email out of the blue with no fanfare at all, just looking at the name and thinking, no, it couldn't be, and then realizing, oh man, it really is. Andrew Stanton wrote in, and we have mentioned this over the years, but he wrote in, and one of his comments was, it is against my misanthropic nature to add to the hue and cry of internet noise, but I cannot resist supporting your praise and insights to Malick's Tree of Life. Bless you for cheering it on and hopefully shaming a few more listeners into going to see it.
And this would have been what? After Wall-E, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so
yeah. Wall-E,
clearly
Finding
after
Nemo,
Finding Nemo,
my two
so
favorite,
huge filmmaker.
Yeah, my two favorite Pixar movies, a great filmmaker, someone I really have a lot of respect for. And to know that he wasn't just writing in saying, I'm really glad you supported this movie and you're getting the word out about it, but he clearly engaged with the review. It prompted him to respond. I think Malick probably had the most to do with that, but we had some small part. And that was, for me, again, rewarding to have a filmmaker of his stature, someone who obviously thinks deeply and seriously about movies, have that kind of response to one of our reviews. What about you? What stood out?
So I hear from listeners frequently about the fights that we've had,
yeah,
since I've been on the show. And I don't know if I would point to those as my favorite reviews.
Never.
Because
they're never fun
to
tape.
They're rough in the moment and you're always regretting maybe what you didn't say. Sometimes I regret how I acted. But I do feel like we've gotten better at them, if
yeah,
that's possible. So I do like the Hateful Eight versus Revenant.
Mm-hmm.
We've kind of just fallen into around the holiday time where afterwards in early January, we've fallen on different sides of two prominent films.
Mm-hmm.
And so we pair those. I think Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle was the year
true
before. And that one's a little rougher of a listen. But I think Revenant and Hateful Eight, we got a chance to really get into it in a way that's maybe that I feel like I'm starting to learn how to bring a little bit of grace to those. So that's one of my favorites.
We can all get better.
I would also say Ex Machina was a lot of fun, mm-hmm, just because it's the flip side of that, right? We both came out of that movie enthralled with it and could just share our enthusiasm,
yeah,
for the movie. And that's clearly more fun than when you're at odds. Another review that was like that, though I don't know how much we added of substance, was What We Do in the Shadows. I just remember kind of giggling a lot during that review.
We did.
So it was fun to record. I, again, you know, how thoughtful it was, I don't know.
Yeah, the Sacred Cow reviews, too, have been really fun. That's something we started really just after you joined the show.
It is, and I'm trying to think if Raiders of the Lost Ark with Michael Phillips was our first one. Maybe we did To Kill a Mockingbird first, but Tom Morris from Clinton, Tennessee, he really appreciated the Raiders review.
Hey, Sound Spotty, and this is Tom Morris from Clinton, Tennessee. I had to call and congratulate you on 600 episodes, and for my all-time favorite episode, I'm biased because I suggested it, but Sacred Cow review of Raiders of the Lost Ark, probably one of the most fascinating discussions you guys have ever had, simply because I'm shocked that Michael Phillips does not like that movie, but the fact that you, me, and Josh all agree it's one of Spielberg's greatest movies, in my opinion, the best movie ever made. Now I'm not talking artistically, but just for the fact you get everything you want in a movie in that one movie, all genres, all excitement, and easily Harrison Ford's most iconic performance.
Yeah, the Raiders Sacred Cow review I enjoyed too. I mean, we both got to pile on Michael Phillips. How fun was that?
We did. Yeah, I mean, and when he's just that wrong,
exactly.
You know, it's an easy conversation from our end. It was our third actually looking at our website after Pulp Fiction started it off. And
that's right.
Then To Kill a Mockingbird.
General favorite moments that come to mind when I think about the last couple of years I've been with the show, the year end Top 10 Roundtable is always so much fun, where we get Michael, we get Scott Tobias now working with us on the Next Picture Show, of course. And my first one was before I had officially joined the
That's
show.
Right.
So this was in December, and I had filled in here or there, and you were like, well, how about you join us? And
yeah, 2011.
It
just
was
throw
really,
you into the fire.
It was really intimidating because I had come to know you a little bit. I knew Scott fairly well. We had conversations in the screening room over the years. Michael, I knew only in passing, and obviously, you know, knew he was a very talented critic. Very talented critic, had a great reputation. So jumping in with the three of you guys on this was intimidating, but we just had so much fun it started to get going. It didn't hurt that you and I both had The Tree of Life as our number one film of that year.
Right.
So yeah, that was good too. That was a lot of fun. And just, you know, in terms of getting to know Michael a little bit, it's both a pleasure and a huge frustration when we record with him. And here's a little behind the scenes stuff to note that, and maybe he's just fooling us, okay? But the guy comes in as we're about to start recording, and
you and I
have like typed up notes. Uh-huh. We've been slaving away over this stuff. He pulls out a sheet of paper and is like, what's his top five again?
Literally.
That's exaggerated, but let me get a few more titles on here.
Uh-huh.
Jots them down. And then, of course, when he starts talking, it's great stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of joy and a whole lot of envy in watching that happen.
For sure. And there was a time, absolutely, where when Sam and I started this show, we thought about having guys like Scott Tobias and Michael Phillips on the show. That was a pipe dream.
Sure.
The notion that they would even give us the time of day, and now for them to be actively wanting to come on the show. I mean, Michael sends us emails, again, a little bit of inside baseball. Occasionally be like, I haven't been on in a while. What's up?
Yeah.
You know, he wants to come on the show.
He's forgiven us for Raiders is how
apparently,
I take that.
But he has fun and he wants to come on. So, yeah, I agree. That's been a big highlight for me. And a little bit more Michael Phillips love here, Taylor Cole in Evanston, Illinois.
I first came to Film Spotting after nearly a year of hearing recommendations for it within the Sound Opinions podcast, one of my other favorite WBZ shows. The moment I knew I was locked in as a Film Spotting listener for life was back in 2012, shortly after I had started subscribing to the podcast. In my first episode, Adam's lukewarm response to the work of pure genius, that is The Cabin in the Woods, left me a little off-put, but I decided to stick with it. I had a long drive the following week and was looking for content to fill it with. On that drive, I listened to the episode wherein you did a Sacred Cow review, before you were truly calling them Sacred Cow reviews, of To Kill a Mockingbird with Michael Phillips. As a Chicagoan, I had read a good amount of Phillips' writing in the Tribune before that, but had never seen him on TV or heard him on Film Spotting. Aside from my instant revelation that if there is ever a Michael Phillips biopic, Jeff Goldblum would be a perfect vocal match in the role.
We've heard that so many times,
yes,
and it's so true.
I also realized just how much I had fallen in love with this podcast I had just discovered a few weeks earlier. The level of discussion was high while still being lighthearted and dynamic. Debate was both informed and spirited, and the difference of opinions was incredibly refreshing, given that many other movie/pop culture podcasts I had been listening to often had an insightful but bland consensus among the panelists. 4 years later, Phillips or no Phillips, it's the same level of insightful, passionate, but respectful debate that makes Film Spotting my very favorite podcast. It challenges my own opinions and guides me to being a better lover of movies with every episode. It's appointment listening every Friday for sure. You'll have to drag me away in chains to make me miss the next live show. Congratulations on 600 episodes. I would be selfish to ask for 600 more, but I'm holding out hope.
Thank you, Taylor. John Andreessen in Atlanta says, I've been listening since episode 21. You guys, Adam, Sam, Maddie, and of course Josh, have gotten me to watch so many movies since I started listening in 05. The biggest influence on me was Werner Herzog. That marathon was very influential to me. Definitely check out his recent interview on WTF. Thank you, and I'll always keep listening. So I haven't heard that interview yet with Marc Maron, but Herzog, obviously a big film spotting favorite. I had not heard of Werner Herzog until I saw Grizzly Man, I think, in 2005. And that's what prompted us to embark on that marathon. And then a few years later, several years later, I'm putting him on a top five list of my desert island directors. And not necessarily saying he's my pure favorite, but we had a lot of criteria, as we usually do for that list. The fact is, for him to make that list and 7-8 years earlier at that point, I didn't know who the guy was. It speaks to what is so satisfying about the show is the discovery, and we do just as much discovery, if not more, than the listeners do.
So a similar experience for me with our Satyajit Ray marathon. Obviously had heard of him, and he had been one of those monumental figures I'd never gotten around to. We finally were able to do a marathon on him, and he is now, his films would be among my top 10 mm-hmm. of all time.
Yep.
That was just such an awakening experience, and also I think made me feel comfortable when coming on to the show to recognize that you guys had these marathons in place, acknowledging that there are these gaps in our film education.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though I had been reviewing for, what, you know, a good decade or more beforehand, still hadn't gotten to see everything, didn't have my mind wrapped around every filmmaker who had ever lived. But critics don't let that out, right? We
yeah.
like to pretend
uh-huh.
like we have all that knowledge. So yeah, just having that in place, it was both comforting and exciting that there was a chance to get to do this. And Satyajit
yeah.
Ray, for me, that's probably the highlight marathon.
Yeah, that was one of the key marathons for me as well. Sometimes, Josh, though, for listeners, the most memorable moments aren't the reviews or the top five lists, the things that we really do stress out about and try to make the most profound, if you will. It's the little asides, and it's the humorous moments, some of which are highly choreographed, as we'll hear in a moment, some of which you can't really choreograph. Let's actually kick this off with two voicemails.
Hi, this is Jamie from Vancouver. I think the moment the show really clicked for me was the fight that Adam and Maddie had to start the episode, when you thought they were really arguing, they're really going to break up, Maddie was really going to leave the show. Absolutely brilliant. That was fairly early in my run listening to Film Spotting, but I've since gone back to the very beginning and still with it. So congrats, guys.
Hey, Adam and Josh. It's Mary Beth from Chicago, better known to Adam as the Token Ginger. Just wanted to call and tell you that the moment that I cite from the last 600 episodes the most, maybe it's because I'm a comedian and I just think it's a great joke, is when Maddie, during the Taking Woodstock review, said that the only person that he could think of worse than Emil Hirsch to play a Vietnam War veteran was Malia Obama. I laughed so hard listening to that in public. I still laugh thinking about it. So I guess it's better that I just, you know, didn't pick any moments from either of you and chose to skip back to one of hosts gone past. Congratulations on 600 episodes. Thank you so much for providing these great insights that you guys do week in and week out, and keep up the good work.
I think that Malia Obama line that Mary Beth references was among Maddie's top five moments on his farewell episode. People still do talk about that line. Classic, classic joke. And then the I'm Still Here fight, Jake Meltzer in Brooklyn, New York says, to this day, in his many Massacre theaters, Adam has never given a better performance, and I don't think he ever will.
That is so true,
yeah.
Jake. I mean, you are convincing
yep.
in that. And that is the moment I am most jealous of when I listen to that again. It's such a brilliant conceit that you guys managed to pull off. You really did.
Yeah, it was Maddie's idea, of course. I just played along, and I tried to be authentic, Josh. So I think apparently I pulled it off. Kathy W. in Alfred, New York agrees with that moment, and she offers a few others.
Most anxiety producing for Kathy, Film Spotting 317, I'm Still Here. I stumbled across Film Spotting at episode 290, so had only been listening regularly for about 6 months when I thought you and Maddie were fighting and breaking up forever, and I was practically crying during the podcast. I had just discovered the best podcast ever, and now it was over? And you never did say you were kidding. I honestly didn't know until the following week when you were back to your normal selves. Oh, my God. Is that true? You didn't
No, Sam, we just went on. We just went on with the show. I mean, no, that was part of the genius of it.
Wonderful. Kathy's favorite marathon, Kieslowski. How did I function prior to seeing the Three Colors trilogy? And then she says, the three movies I never would have heard of but for Film Spotting and now can't stop recommending to people, Holy Motors, Take Shelter, Prince Avalanche. How about that last song?
Mm-hmm.
Movie that I can't forgive you for recommending. I'm still scarred. Killer Joe.
I believe it.
Understandable, Kathy. What I love most about Film Spotting, Kathy says, I so appreciate that you've always looked at film from an inclusive perspective, eager and open to exploring all viewpoints and aware of yourselves when you can't. Never once have I had to cringe because of racist, sexist, homophobic / transphobic or just plain mean undertones. And it's pretty sad how rare that is even in the best of circumstances. It's a pleasure to listen to both of you. And I know you're raising your children to celebrate people in all their blazing variety. The more of us out there fighting the good fight, the better.
Thank you so much, Kathy. Sean from Allentown, Pennsylvania, said his favorite moment, and a lot of people have mentioned this, Maddie's elephant soliloquy on our 300th episode, his number one film of the decade. But some honorable mentions, the knockdown drag-out feuds. There you go, Josh. Sometimes the kids do love to hear mommy and daddy fight. My favorites were American Hustle versus Wolf of Wall Street and The Revenant versus Hateful Eight. Adam, forcing Ed Burns to review a film by his hero, Woody Allen, and a not-so-great one at that. You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, was that the movie? Ed Burns guest hosted on the show, and we reviewed that film. The biggest Woody Allen fan in the world.
If you had told me that that was the title of a movie, I wouldn't have known it was a Woody Allen movie.
Yeah, it's one of those forgetful ones, unfortunately. The countless films the show has introduced me to that have become favorites of mine. Certified Copy, Tangerine, The Act of Killing, Take Shelter, just to name a few, and those are a few great ones. Mentioning Ed Burns there, as I was thinking back on, again, some of those defining moments over 600 episodes, the interviews were something that Sam and I never really set out to do, but we also didn't rule them out. We hoped at some point maybe we'd get a chance to talk with some of our favorite directors and actors. And I remember Ed Burns was the first interview on the show, followed by Rian Johnson after our review of Brick. And then D.B. Sweeney, the actor who I loved in Eight Men Out, he had a movie he directed at the Chicago Film Festival, and he came in studio and we talked to him. So those three interviews, those three guys, all very open and great personalities and just laughing and joking with you and put you at ease right away. I remember the first interview where, for lack of a better word, I felt a little bit of intimidation, and it was also not face-to-face, was with Todd Field. The interview, Little Children had just come out or I had just seen it, and we were talking about that. He was in a studio in California, and obviously he made In the Bedroom, another film I loved. You take those two movies, two very serious films. His persona, I only know him from Nick Nightingale in Eyes Wide Shut. He's not a guy who strikes you as having, let's say, a very gregarious sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very nervous talking to him. And you know what? We had a 30-minute chat, and I think it went well. And at no point did he seem at odds with anything I was saying or think I was a gigantic idiot. And Josh, frankly, at that point, that was very reassuring to me. And over the years talking to, and I could list so many that have been wonderful to talk to. Actually, they've all been wonderful to talk to. But some of those directors who I went in just being a little bit uneasy and being very aware of, Adam, you have to sound smart here. You have to know what you're talking about, or they're gonna know that you're a fraud. Michael Winterbottom, Tom Tickfer, Adam Egoyan, Mike Lee, Steven Soderbergh, getting a chance to talk with them and not having them just throw the microphone down and leave in anger.
Like you're wasting my time.
Right. Yeah. That's never happened yet. So those were big moments for me. Let's close out here, Josh, with some defining top five lists. Angel in Alameda has one.
I think one of my favorite top five lists is the 21st Century Horror Movie list from episode 532. I'm a horror movie fan and love when this genre has films with enough depth to be reviewed. This list is how I discovered House of the Devil and why I gave in to giving Under the Skin a chance. Great picks.
So I'm glad that, again, discovery, that big word, a top five list leading to a listener finding some movies that they maybe otherwise wouldn't have, and those being really crucial movies for them. What about you, Josh? What are the top five lists that you always think back on fondly?
The movie tattoos that we'd get, such a bizarre idea for a top five, but ended up being a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I did enjoy that one. We recently did with Sam, top five non-kids movies to show your kids. That was just great to get together and hang out and talk movies in person. We did that up near Sam's house, and we don't get to do that. So I enjoyed that experience as much as the list, I think. Two silly ones that I managed to – I think I squeezed top five movie Manimals in while you were away 1 week. That was me and Michael. I knew I'd never get you on board.
Would fly.
But you were on board, and this still delights me because I think it might have been your idea.
It was.
Top five Fast and Furious moments, which we were prepared for, by seeing all of the previous
movies.
I think I'd only seen two at that point. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many you had.
I think two.
That was a ton of fun.
It was.
And a bit more seriously, top five Malick scenes. I mean, that was a challenging one, as this week's top five was. But I do love it when we can burrow into the detail and really drill down and talk about specific things and specific moments that delight us in filmmaking. And what better filmmaker to do that with than Malick?
Now, that was a good one. For me, the two top fives that absolutely are my go-to answer anytime someone asks for your favorite top fives or the ones I'd put away in a time capsule, I'm with you, episode 491, top five movie tattoos that we'd get. And as I list a couple others here, you'll hear the common theme. Top five things we've learned from the movies. That was episode 400, that live show. And then another one that Dustin Thornton on Twitter reminded me of, episode 512, top five movie costumes we'd wear. So the key there is weed, right? We're not just taking some topic like great long takes or single location movies, some general topic and coming up with what we hope are good titles. These really require you to think deeply about how you interact with movies. And they're the really personal lists. And that tattoos one is still my all-time favorite. I would add to that a couple others. The tributes that we do sometimes, unfortunate circumstances, but Philip Seymour Hoffman, thinking about our favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman performances and scenes, and even Richard Linklater. When we get to look back at a filmmaker, sometimes it's hard because we're trying to catch up with some movies or look more closely at ones we've seen once or maybe a few times. But when we do actually come in and sit down and talk about him, I definitely feel like I have a greater understanding of what I love about that filmmaker and what makes them tick as artists when we come out of that top five.
For sure. And in the case of the Philip Seymour Hoffman tribute too, I mean, how often when someone leaves so soon like that, do you experience their work through the obituaries or through other written critical appraisals, but to be able to have the chance to really sit down and be with some of their best moments. I mean, I'm just so grateful that we had the opportunity. Mm-hmm. The show gave us the opportunity to do that.
I think as we put a bow on this here, Josh, the theme, or certainly one of the common themes that has come through throughout the show's history and in this segment in particular, building it around the listener feedback, that listener interaction, by far, when people ask me, what's your favorite part of doing the show? I still very much enjoy every time we sit here behind the mics and talk to each other and engage about movies. But it's when we do live shows. It's when we do meetups. It's when we get to actually not only interact over email, but the face-to-face communication with listeners has always been so much fun.
Well, and that's where you feel it the most, are at the live shows, right? And we've done the last couple of years our January wrap party, looking back at the year that was. And to be with listeners in that space makes it's daunting for me to be in front of a live audience still. And I felt the first live show we did, which was 400 for me, my first live show, that was so much easier because everyone there was hoping things would go well, right? They were on your side. They may be disagreeing with you loudly about a movie or your opinion, but still in the spirit of fun. And I feel like our last wrap party in January, that was richer than it ever had been before. And that was such a fun show because the listeners were right there for us the whole time. I don't know if I could have survived that singing massacre theater we tried to pull
Sweet
off.
Sweet child of mine. We did pull it off.
Without knowing that the crowd there would be on our side.
No.
And they were.
That's true. And they always have been. That's a perfect transition because when I was preparing for this segment, I was searching for some information in Gmail, looking back on maybe a listener's name or something that was brought up, and I was trying to find some information. And I came across a tag, one of my labels in Gmail, that I had forgotten was even there, and it was called Sympathy. And this was a tag that I put in place because after my dad passed away suddenly in 2010, Maddie talked about it on the show the week I was gone. And I got something like 120 emails from listeners with incredibly thoughtful, really touching comments and just a lot of support. And that was really startling again to go back and see. And it touched me all over again. And I think about these 11 and a half years, again, thinking about these 600 episodes, three co-hosts, Sam started a family, got married, had three kids. I added two kids. I lost my dad. I lost a sister, a younger sister along the way, which I didn't even talk about on the show at all. And part of the reason, Josh, was it's still very hard to talk about, but also because there was a part of me that I think felt like I'm so burdened by this. If I mention this on air, I'm going to burden listeners with it because they always are so much on our side. And I guess maybe I now have done that retroactively, and I apologize for that. But my point is just how much of a connection we've managed to develop and listeners have managed to develop with us over 11 years of doing the show and through three co-hosts is remarkable, for lack of a better word.
And we were hoping to celebrate that connection with another live show to celebrate 600. That fell through. We're going to do something in November we'll have more information about. But we are going to try to get together with some folks on the date that we had planned for the live
show. Yeah, that's true. August 27th.
We don't know where or when at this point. So maybe we can point people to Twitter feed at FilmSpotting or the Facebook page once we get that settled. But we're going to be hanging out. There's a couple of listeners we know who are going to be in town anyway. So it'll be fun to get to do that with people and celebrate a little bit more live.
Yes, it will. Again, our sincere gratitude to everyone who has stuck with us over the years and everyone who shared some of your favorite film spotting moments. If you have a comment about this or any other episode of the show, email feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. You can find that number under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm at FilmSpotting. Josh is at Larson on Film.
Also at FilmSpotting.net, you can find 11 years, 600 shows of reviews, marathons, interviews, and top fives. Those are all in the show archives. And while you're there, how about you vote in the current Film Spotting poll? We're asking who played the robot better, Michael Fassbender or Alicia Vikander? And please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts. We've got Film Spotting SVU and The Next Picture Show. You can find both of those in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Out in wide release this weekend, Don't Breathe, the horror movie from the director of the Evil Dead remake. Hands of Stone, the Roberto Duran biopic with Edgar Ramirez and Robert De Niro. Mechanic Resurrection, Jason Statham, Jessica Alba, and Tommy Lee Jones, along with Michelle Yeoh in that one. In limited release, we'll highlight a few titles here. A Tale of Love and Darkness, Natalie Portman's directing debut based on the memoir by Amos Oz, and lo and behold, Reveries of the Connected World. I can recommend Werner Herzog's latest. Morris from America. This was a Sundance hit, a fish-out-of-water story where a 13-year-old relocates from the U.S. to Germany with a single dad. It stars Craig Robinson. Next week on the show, we are planning to discuss Morris from America, which you can probably see and play along because it's currently available via cable on demand and rental on most streaming platforms. And of course, again, opening in limited release this weekend. We'll probably get to some Lo and Behold talk, and we will have the finale of our Nordic cinema marathon, the Icelandic film Rams, which is also available via iTunes and a lot of other streaming platforms. It's also on Netflix. So this isn't a marathon where you have to go in chronological order or there's any real structure to this. It is never too late to start the marathon. You can start with the final film. Again, it's Rams from Iceland.
Our featured artist this week was Luke Winslow King. The music comes from his forthcoming album, I'm Glad Trouble Don't Last Always. It's due September 30. That album is from Chicago's Bloodshot Records. More information is available at lukewinslowking.com.
Bloodshot has a special place in our hearts here at Film Spotting. It was, I think, the first music label that gave us permission to use music by their artists on our show. So if you go back through the archives, you'll hear for a long stretch exclusively Bloodshot artists on the show.
We also want to give special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org for this 600th episode. A huge, especially big thank you to producers Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. And thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and, of course, all of the listeners who make up the Film Spotting Advisory Board.
So many people over the years that have kept us doing what we're doing, including all of you, the listeners. Thank you for that.
For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
Happy birthday, Frank.
Thank you, Hal.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.